So it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Angel Mendez-Montoya. Dr. Mendez-Montoya is a member of the Southern Dominican Province in the United States. He earned his doctorate in philosophical theology from the University of Virginia and was a scholar in residence at Cambridge University as he completed his dissertation. He currently teaches theology and philosophy at Universidad Iberoamericana in Mexico City, Mexico. Dr. Mendez-Montoya is a contributing author to Blackwell Companion to Catholicism and the recently published edited volume Creating Ourselves, African Americans and Hispanic Americans on Popular Culture and Religious Expression, edited by Anthony Penn and Benjamin Valentin. His latest book is entitled The Theology of Food. I'm sensing a theme here. The Theology of Eating and the Eucharist. From Wiley Blackwell, 2009, which one reviewer calls, and I quote, a significant contribution to the effort to apply theological thinking to the everyday realities of embodied life, end quote. While we wish he could be here with us in person today, as Sarah has already explained, the U.S. State Department would not allow this. But we are grateful for the technology that enables him to present his paper remotely. Dr. Mendez's presentation today is entitled Vicissitudes of the Margins, an HIV/AIDS Theological Journey. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Mendez-Montoya.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here, even if it's virtually. I am very happy to be here and to break with all this marginalization and putting borders. So technology now is working in our favor. Thank you so much. The Webster Dictionary defines the term vicissitude as that with a quality or state of being changeable. It implies mutability, a natural change or mutation visible in nature or in human affairs. Vicissitude can also mean a favorable or unfavorable event or situation that occurs by chance, a fluctuation of a state or condition, the vicissitudes of life, a difficulty or hardship attendant on a way of life, a career, or a course of action usually beyond one's control. I am here to share with you my own story and experiences of hardship and joy, the vicissitudes in my own life. The intention here is neither to create a narcissistic nor an exhibitionist gaze, but it is rather an invitation to make theology together, even in the midst of hardship and chaos, a sense of constant fluctuation, a state of not knowing or not having absolute control. My presentation, my being present here, virtually present here among you, is biographical, understanding biography as a theological place. I am a theologian, but sort of a queer hybrid, Mexican, gay, HIV positive, Dominican brother from the U.S. Southern Dominican Province. I guess this bizarre nomenclature has something, though surely not everything, to do with my being born in a borderland, very near from where you are now, in Mexicali, Baja California, a geographical chunk of the gray wall, El Muro, that divides Mexican and U.S. territories. It was not easy to have been born gay in La Frontera, at the border. If we understand the term vicissitude as something that contains an internal paradox, that is something that is simultaneously harsh and soft, sweet and sour, that is saddening and rejoicing, then I can retrospectively say that I have been experienced a life full of paradoxes. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, while growing up in Mexicali, I experienced the hardship of a violent macho culture. Although I believe I was aware of my gay orientation since early childhood, I nevertheless had to learn to hide it and make it invisible, and never to talk about my homosexual feelings with family or friends, always hiding behind a mask as a means of protection. The paradox here displays both a hating and unwelcoming environment. At the same time, I experience real love and caring from my parents and family, knowing that they always accepted me just the way I am. We seldom talked about sexuality with my parents at home, yet I am grateful for the love my parents, my family, and close friends showed through actions beyond words. As I became a teenager, I also had to learn the discipline of masking my own sexual orientation in order to be accepted. Yet, above all, I had a supportive life growing up in La Frontera. Growing up in La Frontera between Mexicali and Calexico made me aware of borders and walls. We Mexicans were never fully accepted on the other side of the Mexican border, for we have always been the other for the U.S. citizens, yet we are a great commodity for their economic growth, both as customers and providers of harsh and abusive labor conditions. I became used to the constant flux of people coming and going from Mexico to the U.S. Some cross the border legally, but many without documents, mostly those looking for some improvement, following a fictional dream of the American way of life. Some are also escaping persecution and harassment. As I learned, there are many gay and lesbian Latinos and Latinas who venture moving away from their homelands where they suffered discrimination. My life experience had first a drastic change when I moved from my small border town to gigantic Mexico City when I was about 17. Perhaps escaping from my own sexuality, although we never fully know God's deepest intentions, I joined the Mexican Dominicans. I grew up as a Catholic, and since early childhood, I had a great orientation towards God and the sacred, liturgical performance, community making, and the blending of faith and reason. My home parish was run by Dominicans, and since I was 12 years old, I studied pastoral and liturgical theology, church history, and Bible studies. Was my entering the OP, the Order of Preachers, a way of escaping my sexual orientation? Maybe so. But I must acknowledge a true sense of mystery that also speaks to my own vocation of responding to an early call to listening to God's voice and sharing God's message in love and compassion with others. However, at that time, some Mexican Dominicans in charge of formation were ruthlessly homophobic, and I ended up leaving them as I was coming to accept my own homosexuality. James Allison, a gay Catholic priest and former Dominican, points out in his several lectures, essays, and books that the homophobia inside the house of religious formation is often a consequence of pathological self-hatred, a learning to lie to oneself and to live a lie. I was aware of those mechanisms, and by God's grace, did not allow their pathologies to devastate me. The paradox here was my learning to accept myself as God's beloved child, even in the midst of hatred, rejection, and harassment, even if it came from my Dominican brothers. I didn't allow the vicissitudes of that transition from my life in a religious house to a secular life to bitter my soul. On the contrary, I knew God was ever near, and that I had so much to learn about God and myself beyond the framework and the walls of a religious institution. At that time, leaving the OP became a blessing, for I encountered two great loves in my life, philosophy and dance, another queer hybrid that has moved my thinking and my life. I started a bachelor's program in philosophy at UNAM, National University of Mexico, taking philosophy classes at the university in the mornings, while also taking modern dance classes in the afternoons. Again, the vicissitudes of life, understood here as a situation that occurs by chance, my encounter with dance also came by chance, something I cannot fully understand through reason, but only with my heart. That period of my life was a joyful blend of critical thinking and body awareness. It was precisely that interweaving that deepened my search for the divine, for it did not diminish my appetitus, my hunger for God, but rather opened up new ways of understanding and experiencing God. During this period of my life, I became truly happy and felt blessed by being gay, experiencing a divine, queer love. The many and already familiar vicissitudes in my life directed me to re-enter the order with the U.S. Southern Dominican Province, the San Martin de Province, in the United States in 1993. I had decided that my being gay was not an impediment to follow my call. Unfortunately, when I shared this view at an interview with the then vocations director of the Mexican province, he promptly replied that being homosexual was a terrible disability, similar to being blind or hearing impaired, and so by no means could I be accepted in the province. Through this shockingly painful meeting with the vocation director, I once again experienced marginalization, a sense of being an outsider, unwelcomed. But as always, and as the Christians who have experienced the cross are that which brings about resurrection, I realized that dying to that possibility of becoming a Dominican in my own country was going to bring about a new and exciting life ahead of me, and so I trusted God's queer designs. After 2 years of studying philosophy at UNAM, I had become a successful professional dancer and had to decide to interrupt my university studies because the professional demands left me without much time to study and write papers, unable to continue fulfilling my students' responsibilities. Although it was painful to decide to interrupt my studies, I knew deep in my heart that one day I would return to intellectual life. An unexpected shift came to my life when I received an invitation to enroll as a student for a bachelor's program in dance at the University of Texas in Austin, Texas. In exchange for the scholarship, I was invited to work with the university's professional dance company, the Sharir Bustamante Dance Company. In Austin, I was delighted to meet Dominican brothers living in town, and I was thankful to accept their invitation to live with them while studying at UT, encouraging me to continue discerning my vocation. Thanks to the welcoming spirit of Father James McDonough, OP, I had a chance to bring intense academic life, community, and pastoral life together. Luckily, the St. Martin de Porres Dominicans do not discriminate gay people, and so I happily decided to join them after I finished my BA in dance. I was also gladly surprised when the Southern Dominicans also encouraged me to continue dancing as a Dominican, following a great religious tradition of Dominican brothers and sisters consecrated to and understanding the arts as a way of preaching God's good news. The following mutation in my life was the most painful of all. It brought disruption to a harmonious life I had during my formation years as a Dominican cooperator brother. As a Dominican student, I developed a sense of being at peace with my own sexuality while learning to integrate dance, philosophy, and theology along with prayer and community life, including pastoral experience working with Latino communities in Denver, Colorado, while my novitiate year in St. Louis, Missouri, while I was studying philosophy and theology. My experience as a Latino in the U.S. had somehow been privileged, particularly when considering being in the U.S. within academic territories and with a religious status, vis-a-vis the vast majority of Latinos and Latinas that are most vulnerable and easily exploited, as the history of U.S. Latin American political and economic relationships so clearly reveals. Just take a look at the current situation in Arizona, for instance. Even though I was privileged, I was never blind to this cruel reality of exploitation and great injustice to my people, and so my pastoral experience among mis hermanos y hermanas allowed me to ground in the soul of tears and laughter de mi gente. In faith, I have no doubt that such an experience provided a solid ground for my stand up here and now in front of you, despite the painful changes that I was about to change in my life. A length of my HIV positive status between the pre and post 9/11 event while starting my doctoral studies at UVA. By that time, I was planning to apply for residency and did not know all the details of the legal migration system. I will show below my province file an application to my residency after misinformed legal advice, which resulted in the application being rejected. We were also advised to request a permit to stay in the country, even though there was an inadmissibility law to HIV people applying for residency in the U.S. But time kept running, and between weak strategies and mistakes, I overstayed illegally in the country for a year and a half until I could no longer stand the situation and asked my provincial for permission to move out of the country and finish writing my doctoral dissertation elsewhere. Luckily, by 2004, I had just successfully defended my dissertation project, and I was able to write my dissertation whatever I wanted. I am really grateful to have been invited to be a scholar in residency at Cambridge University in the UK with the purpose of writing my dissertation. Again, as earlier in my life, bad karma brought good karma, for my dissertation director, Professor John Milbank, had just moved back with his family to his homeland in England, and so I was able to have periodical meetings with him. I was also blessed by the hospitality of the Cambridge Dominicans and by living in an environment of prayer, community, study life, and pastoral life, an ideal space for writing my dissertation. After obtaining my doctoral degree, I came back to my homeland and have been living and working in Mexico City as a philosophy and theology professor since 2007. Because I am HIV positive, I was rejected by the U.S. government, and because I stayed illegally in the country and now have a 10-year bar, this allowed me to enter the U.S. territory. As we know, the inadmissibility policy to HIV people was lifted quite recently at the beginning of our current year here in 2010. While in England, I once applied for a waiver to enter the U.S. in order to be able to deliver a paper at the ACTUS national meeting at which I had been invited to speak. ACTUS goes for the Academy of Catholic Hispanic Theologians from the U.S., as you probably know. I had to deliver my paper by video, but then the permit was rejected too, the waiver application, and I had to deliver the paper by video conference from Cambridge to Washington, D.C., as I'm doing now from Mexico City to San Diego. In spite of my being considered inadmissible in the U.S., we managed to transcend the borders by speaking virtually at that ACTUS memorable conference. I am really happy and honored to have received an invitation to speak at this timely conference on migration and theology. I told my story to Sarah Azaransky from the project of Live Theology and let the project know my legal dilemma and the possibilities of not being able to enter the country and speak at the conference. I am very grateful that despite the inconvenience of my situation, I was nevertheless still asked to participate. I say this, it is timely, for my own experience is an illustration, although a minor illustration when compared to the horrible stories of discrimination against my people, of the great suffering and struggles that many Latinos and Latinas face every day under the tragic violence of U.S. migration policies. Again, let's just recall Arizona. Before going in to share some last remarks about my personal story, interpreted from a theological horizon, I want to further share with you a letter of application for a waiver I wrote to the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City. This is a letter that better explains the legal details pertaining to my illegal overstay in the U.S. and expresses my request to enter the country in order to speak at this conference. Dear Sir or Madam, my name is Angel Mendez. I am an avowed religious brother in the Catholic Church and a citizen of Mexico. I presently reside at this above address. I write this letter in conjunction with my application for a B1, B2 visitor's visa in order to request a waiver of the 10-year bar I face due to my unlawful presence in the United States following the denial of my adjustment of status application in October 2002. I require a BA B2 visa in order to attend and speak at a conference entitled Theology, Migration and the Borderlands at the Spring Institute of Live Theology, which will also be hosted by the University of San Diego. Specifically, I have been invited to speak at the conference on Tuesday, April 27th. The conference will take place between April 26th and 28th. By way of background, I hold a BA from the University of Texas, an MA in Philosophy from St. Louis University, an MA in Theology from the Aquinas Institute of Theology, and a PhD in Philosophical Theology from the University of Virginia. Enrolled my doctoral dissertation as a scholar in residence at the University of Cambridge. In pursuing my studies in the United States, I held a series of F1 student visas. I maintained lawful status without incident until approximately 2002. At that time, my religious superiors from the U.S. Dominican province filed an I-36 petition on my behalf, seeking to classify me as a religious worker. The petition was approved, and my immigration representative at that time, Miriam Mesadieu from Catholic Charities in Miami, Florida, filed an I-485 on my behalf. However, by this time I had learned that I was HIV positive. Back on those years, it was a compulsory request to have an HIV test if anyone was intending to apply for a U.S. residency. After this terribly sad news, my superiors and I questioned how this would impact my eligibility for adjustment of status. We were told that I could qualify for a waiver despite the fact that I had no qualifying relatives in the United States. On October 1st, 2002, my application for residency was denied based on my HIV status. Mrs. Mesadieu informed me and the order that she would apply for a waiver of the HIV bar and that I would remain lawfully in the U.S. during this process. So I continued with my doctoral studies at UVA. I started my academic program on the fall of the year 2000. In July 2003, the order decided to transfer my case to the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, Inc., clinic. After the order discovered egregious errors with my case and those of several other foreigners, members of the order requested that clinic make an effort to regularize my status so that I could remain lawfully in the U.S. Clinic informed us that it would file a request for a deferred action status on my behalf. A deferred action is a very difficult legal process that is given to very special people. Basically, they ask the government to ignore the case and not to do anything about it. But it was really hard because we had to find a lot of letters from people recommending me. At the advice of the clinic attorney and my superiors, I continued pursuing my doctoral degree at the University of Virginia. After several months, my superiors concluded that in light of the past mistakes of Ms. Mesadieu, they sent my papers to the clinic to have a deferred action. But the board of the Department of Religious Studies at that time gave me a permission to complete and defend my doctoral dissertation from outside the U.S. In August 18, 2004, I departed the U.S. of my own accord because it was becoming very difficult for me to be illegally in the United States. By that time, I was already a year and a half, and the clinic was not doing anything about my case. And so finally, I decided that it was time for me to leave because I couldn't stay any longer illegally in the States. After remaining in Mexico for 6 months, where I went to undergo a research project, I then moved to Cambridge, UK to start writing my dissertation. It was convenient to moving to England, given the fact that the director of my dissertation, John Milbank, was living in the UK with his family. While being a scholar in residence at Cambridge, I was invited to present a paper at the National Meet of ACTUS. Clinic encouraged me to apply for a visitor's visa and waiver with their assistance so that I could attend the conference. Unfortunately, the U.S. Embassy in London denied my application, citing a lack of evidence of my ties to Mexico. Clinic sought a review of their decision, but this too was denied. In 2009, I learned for the first time that the deferred action request that Clinic began to prepare was never filed, as well as the true reasons my B1, B2 was denied in London 4 years earlier. With the assistance of a friend in the United States, and after much wrangling with Clinic staff, I was able to obtain copies of my file from Clinic. I was very disappointed with the documents I received, as they seemed to show that dating back to my first meeting with them, Clinic made repeated errors in handling my case. Since returning from England in January 2006, I have been residing in Mexico City. I have made several trips internationally, always returning to my home in Mexico City. I understand that I was unlawfully present in the U.S. in the past. This was after many years of lawful status and resulted from a combination of errors mainly made by other persons on my behalf. I certainly never intended to violate my student's visa or to remain unlawfully in the U.S. One error was compounded by another, and this resulted in my remaining in the country unlawfully. As soon as my superiors and I realized that the situation could not be rectified, I immediately departed the U.S. and have not returned since. I respectfully ask that you favorably consider my request for a waiver so as to allow me to briefly visit the U.S. to attend and speak at the above-described conference at the University of San Diego. As set forth above, my failure to maintain lawful status was largely due to the fact that I was following the advice of my superiors at the order and the legal counsel they had working on my immigration matters. I realized they did not mean any hurt, but the final outcome did hurt, particularly my person. Should my request for a waiver be approved and my visa granted, my only intention is to travel to the U.S. for the conference and then return home. I believe this will be a very enriching experience, most certainly and personally for me. It will be a way of healing the deep wounds left by the whole case, and I hope that my presence at the conference will be enriching as well for the people attending this event. I thank you for your consideration of my request. Sincerely, Brother Angel Mendez, OP, PhD. So as you know, this permit is still somewhere in Washington, and they're still processing. They called me a few minutes ago before the conference to tell me that they are still processing, and they apologize for the inconveniences of not having the permit ready. So now, and as a way of ending my talk, I would like to share with you some brief conclusive theological remarks. Although more than drawing conclusions, I would rather open the floor for questions, inviting the listeners to ponder upon the following three very brief points. 1. Homosexuality and HIV, the inadmissible other. Through my own experience in flesh and blood, I can say that practices and methods of discrimination have not yet ended, including and particularly within this so-called land of freedom. Although some gay rights have been slowly implemented in the U.S. policies, gays and lesbians, bisexual and transgender people are not always welcome everywhere. HIV became to be known as a homosexual disease, although there is an increasing number of heterosexuals who are becoming HIV positive in this country and in many other countries. There is nevertheless a cultural stigma that marks homosexuality as a disease in itself, which an HIV condition only confirms. There are fundamentalist Christians that shout against gay people in the streets and yell that HIV is only a rightly divine punishment to their sinful condition of being homosexuals. There are cities and villages where gay people are openly unwelcome, constantly harassed, some are terrorized, tortured, and some are even killed. The bar against accepting HIV people in the U.S. reflects this policy of inadmissibility as a non-Christian practice of anti-hospitality. The other is a leper, the one we do not want near, but keep far away from us, away from our secured borderlands. What are these reasons behind legal labeling someone as inadmissible? And what is the Christian response to this violent stigma? As Christians, when are we going to learn to see the crucified and resurrected Christ in the outsider and the most vulnerable, as envisioned in the Gospel of Mark 25? The fact of a delay in my application has to do, I believe, with this triple condition of being Mexican, gay, and HIV, thus becoming what Marcella Altus Reid called a triple outsider. I wonder what the response from the DHS would have been if the same time of waiver application had come from a Canadian or a European citizen. Would the case be treated the same? As the biblical narratives challenge us to repeat God's gift of hospitality among one another, particularly with the stranger, can we recognize the presence of God in the alien other, the one who is inadmissible? 2. Queer theology and border thinking, a queer decolonial alternative. All Christian theology is already queer. It proclaims God that becomes flesh, dies, and resurrects, a God that, contrary to the normal cycle of religious violence, reverses the same violent cycle from within rather than from without, bringing about peace, reconciliation, and hospitality instead of destruction and hostility. We as Christians believe in a queer God, who cannot be ultimately labeled by any linguistic description, for God is ineffable, a name beyond all names, a deep mystery, an infinite love that cannot be fully grasped by human insight or by reasoning alone. That is why faith becomes an extravagance, the locus of receiving divine grace or a divine gift that allows us to desire to know God. As Catherine Pickstock rightly argues in her essay, Eros and Emergence, our desire for God reveals her being already present among us, fulfilling in our present the original divine desire to be near us, a desire that comes from an original past, but that also promises a future eschatological union, giving meaning to a search for God in the present, nourishing our human appetitus for God. Such a union of desires, human and divine, illustrates our perpetual condition of being at the border of our human condition, la frontera between divine and human agency. However, al otro lado del muro, at the other side of the human frontier, we find an hospitable God, never excluding, but always ready to welcome us and to share divinity with us, making us participants of her divine love. At the other side of divinity, we find ourselves in a place without walls, becoming neither alien nor any longer the other vis-a-vis God, but one with God in an all-loving divine embrace. Through incarnation, God also subverts the boundaries between divinity and humanity and radicalizes his intimate and immanent relationship without leaving transcendence behind, but actually revealing divinity as already analogically contained in all creation, God's kenotic descent as our plenitudinous ascending to her through the resurrected Christ and in the company of the Holy Spirit. This total affinity of God and creation, particularly expressed in the midst of human condition, display a prior affinity and love within the Trinitarian community's perfect and perpetual exchange of gifts and reciprocity expressed by a relational, ever-dynamic, ever-living God. Colonial Christianity forgot and betrayed this welcoming divine logic and constructed instead its own logic of uncovering and excluding the other, as Enrique Dussel puts it. The construction or invention of Latin America is paradigmatic of this geopolitics of exclusion and exercise of extortion and domination upon the natives of these lands. The Mexican-U.S. political relationship still continues reproducing this same colonizing logic, whereby Mexican citizens are always at loss in front of a dominating country that excludes and exploits my people. The exclusion of gay people, particularly those who, like myself, are HIV positive, unmasks this practice of violence that colonizes the other and that has labeled us inadmissible. In the midst of this chaotic, hostile, and hurtful reality, how to perform a truly Christian decolonizing practice rooted in a vision of a Trinitarian God that subverts the geopolitical and ontological borderlands and welcomes everyone, including particularly those who are outcast? And number three, between subversion and emergence, the vicissitudes of the margins. God's subversion on the cross reverses our daily violent and crucifying practices, transforming violence into peace and forgiveness, bringing about eternal life from within the realm of death. The crucified God is the expression of God's ultimate solidarity with those who are crucified in our midst. God's kenosis is not nullifying or self-annihilating, but subversively brings about plenitude where there is lack. It affirms and welcomes where there is rejection and marginalizing. This subversive divine love is a counter-practice of the coercive politics of the nation-state migratory system in the midst of a rapidly globalizing world under the dominating empire of neoliberalism and capitalist practice of desire based on rivalry and competition, a pathological erotics of desire as the absolute consumption and domination of the other. But God's practice of love and inclusion emerges and gives birth to a new erotic agapeic union, the ecclesial human-divine community, a community founded upon practices of inclusion and hospitality. I realize there is something subversive in my being Mexican, a Dominican brother, gay, and HIV positive. I am aware that this hybrid condition puts me further back to the margins. I must confess that this is a painful place to be in, but I refuse being victimized. Like all you patient listeners, I am also a child of God. For within the vicissitudes of my marginalizing story, I have encountered incredible support from family, friends, and colleagues. And in that human embrace, I found God's own embrace. Paradoxically, I found laughter where there had been so many tears. I found so much hope, regardless of constant rejection, even now back in my own homeland, where on the daily basis there is direct and indirect discrimination against gay people, and particularly against people living with HIV. Sadly, the Mexican Catholic clergy is no exception, and I often suffer discrimination from within the church, while usually being welcomed by the secular world. Nevertheless, there are always small niches and communities within and outside the church that have shown me an enormous support, which sustains me and keeps me hopeful. In their support and care, I also encounter God. Again, I am very thankful to you all for allowing me to share my own biographical story, my own theological experience of being situated on the margins of an exclusionary system. The vicissitudes of my life have allowed me to face a whole world of possibilities where things could go one way or another. This is also the face of mystery, wherein the ego lacks absolute control. It is right there in the uncertainties, ambiguities, and paradoxes of life where God can also be found. My own life experience tells me so. In spite of these vicissitudes of the margins, in faith, I realize that this situation is not final, but just the beginning of a long struggle, an emergence of God, an event of grace. Thank you very much. Thank you. I would like to open to questions, and please come to the microphone so that I can hear.
So are there questions? Would anyone like to come in and speak into the microphone? And we can repeat it.
¿Ya apagó?
Thank you. My name is Bill Raddatz. I'm a Lutheran pastor here. The Lutheran Church just went through a great debate about a welcoming statement to homosexual persons. And it split the church. Many of those congregations are leaving. And it's interesting, one of the arguments there was, we're going to lose partners in other countries who don't have the same understanding that we do in terms of being able to be a welcoming church there, and that's going to hurt the church. In some ways, I don't know enough about the situation in Mexico right now, and I guess my question is, can you fill us in a little bit more about the church and the gay community? And I think marriage recently got approved in Mexico City, if I remember right, gay marriages. So what is kind of the political and theological climate in Mexico in particular? Can you help with that?
Thank you so much for the question. It's a very interesting question. And the same, I guess some things are similar to the situation in the United States. We are also divided in this kind of a bipolar reality regarding homosexual persons in Mexico. Yes, on the one hand, we have the secular laws that have accepted gay marriage, and I'm very happy for that. But the church in Mexico is very, very homophobic. And so it's, I have experienced a lot of discrimination within the church. On the other hand, though, from the grassroots, some communities that are Catholics and that are gay or pro-gay issues, they are speaking up. And there is a group called Mujeres Católicas por el Derecho a Decidir, Catholic Women for the Right to Decide. And there are Catholic women that are very upfront, and they are speaking up for social justice and also speaking up for sexual orientation justice rights. And so we also have this experience that is sweet and sour. On the one hand, very ultra-conservative Catholics, for instance, that are very homophobic. And on the other hand, we have these small groups, always marginal, always outsiders of their own church, but very faithful, though. Even in spite of their rejection, they still continue wanting to be Catholics and continue getting together for worship and for discussions and for studies. We also have Protestant churches here, and some Lutherans as well, and Anglicans, and Episcopalians, Methodists. For me personally, I think that they are much more avant-garde than the Catholics. They are much more accepting and to these sort of issues than the Catholics. And unfortunately, this reality of the gay, of the conservative Protestants leaving the church in the United States and in England is bringing a lot of people that are against homosexuals in their church And they are becoming now Catholics because they think in Catholicism we officially reject gays. And so now we are having the Catholics, we are having a lot of people from Anglican churches and for Methodists and other Lutheran churches that are coming to join the Catholic Church just because they don't want to be with their churches where they accept homosexuals. So I guess, my guess is that in the future, Catholicism is going to become more conservative and less accepting to homosexual people. Unfortunately, I don't know.
Hi, Anel. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed your talk. I wondered if you could speak a little bit to the privileged status that you have in certain areas and the fluidity of identities in that sense. Because, and in the one hand, you know, as someone who's ordained, who's a man, who's well-educated, you carry privilege in the society. And so I wondered if you could talk a bit about your experience of that. Do you feel at times tension between the areas in your social location where you're excluded and other areas where you do feel doors open? And if there are perhaps unlikely coalitions that emerge for you out of that, for instance, with Católicas por el Derecho a Decidir, La Mujeres, you know, if there are ways that that you stand with women who aren't able to be ordained, perhaps, or who people who are lay in general or are not educated, are there certain ways that, like, new political alliances can form to move forward with a justice platform?
Thank you very much. Yes, yes, it's true. My own experience was one of privilege because of the academic world and also the religious life. Although I'm not ordained, I'm a brother. Within the Dominicans, we have ordained brothers and non-ordained brothers, and they call the non-ordained cooperative brothers. And in fact, when I joined the order, I was a cleric candidate, but then I changed my status precisely because at that time there were all these discussions on women's ordination, and I felt that it was terrible that I could choose to become a priest, but a woman could not choose to become a priest. And so, among other things, I decided to stay as a brother instead of becoming a priest. So I think that there are ways in which I have also trying to solidarize with other people, especially women who are not allowed to become priests in the Catholic Church. But as far as the Latinos, as I said before in the paper, I worked in all the places where I stayed in the United States while I was studying. I worked with communities of Latinos, migrants, Latinos, and there was a lot of coalition work doing programs of justice and health issues and several ways of helping the community of Latinos, especially those who were illegally in the United States, trying to help them. And then now from here, from Mexico, I'm trying to do as much as I can. I guess little by little is going to be a way of working with people that are HIV and also hearing stories from people that are in Mexico. But still, I realize that my sufferings are very little compared to the sufferings of other people in the daily basis. Yet, at the same time, I also see that by being Mexican and gay and HIV, that also puts me in the margin. So I find myself in great empathy with a lot of people that are marginalized in Mexico. And so I think over there we find ways of understanding one another and also hopefully little by little finding ways of creating works together, coalition, that we could work together towards more trying to find justice in their own lives.
Hello. I'm in Vanessa Oakes' class this year on food, and I was wondering if you could share a little bit about your gastronomic theology and how it helps you through this and helps you with this whole process that you've been talking about.
Thank you very much for the question. One of my favorite questions, of course, my favorite theme. I'm very passionate about the this whole subject on food. I think now in a, such a globalized world where so many people are dying of hunger while other people are, there's so much waste of food, for instance, and many other issues related to food, I think it's a very timing moment to speak about issues related to, or matters related to food. I also was very happy to take classes with Vanessa Ox in at UVA. She was really a key person in my becoming passionate about this subject. In my case, my own experience is more, again, biographical too, because I grew up in a family where all the weekends we opened the house of hospitality and cook for other people. And families, friends, a lot of people came to my house every weekend to eat because my father was a fantastic cook. And also, well, being a Mexican, the table is a very central place for community making. In the table, we talk, we discuss, we fight, we reconcile, etc., etc. And so table is also a very important place. But I guess for me, how it has helped me, the subject or thinking theologically about food and regarding my HIV positive is the whole thing about hospitality. A table is a place of hospitality, and God is a God of hospitality. Not only God nourishes us, but God becomes nourishment in the Eucharist for those who believe in the Eucharist. But even if you don't believe, I guess it's still very extravagant, this symbol of God becoming nourishment, the ingesting of God. And so I explore that theology of God's superabundance and God's superabundant generosity to all people. I explore that in my own dissertation that now has become the book. For me, the most important thing is the whole exercise or performance of becoming hospitable to one another. And here, in the case of people rejected for their sexual orientation, we see an anti-Christian, anti-hospitality practice. And so I think that we Christians have to encourage people. We have to learn how to become Eucharistic also as well. As the same way as God becomes food for us and nourishes us, so we are called to become food for one another and nourishing one another, especially those who most hunger, especially those who are most vulnerable, in this case, people who are HIV or are suffering of AIDS.
Hi, John Fanistel. I'm just curious to know, do you still have family in Mexicali? And are you able to, do you visit them frequently or not at all? And how has Mexicali changed? When were you last there? What's your impression of life in Mexicali?
Thank you so much. Yes, all my family is in there in Mexicali. Everyone except one sister who lives here in Mexico City. I haven't been able to live near my family in the last, I don't know, 20 years. And now, since I moved in Mexico City 3 years ago, I live very close my sister and her family. So I'm very happy to live close my family or nearby my family. But all my family, I have three more sisters and one brother, and all of them are in Mexicali. My parents, both my father and mother, died already, and so all I have is my brother and sisters and many nephews and nieces and great nephews and great nieces as well. And I don't go very often, but I was planning, now that I was going to go to San Diego, I told them that I may come and visit them for a few days. My sister from Mexicali called me this morning to ask me if I was going to be able to go, and I had to give her the bad news, the sad news that I couldn't go. So it's painful, all this situation. They know my situation, HIV and the whole suffering in the United States with the inadmissibility law and all that stuff, and they have been of a great support, and I'm very, very grateful to their support, but it's sad to have these experiences right now. Mexicali, when I left, and Mexicali now, is a different city, I guess. It has grown so much. In fact, I heard the other day in the news that Mexicali is one city in Mexico that has grown fast, very fast in the last 10 years. And so now it's a very huge city. It used to be a small town, but now it's a big city. The heat is still very warm, very hot, and that hasn't changed. And now, as you know, you all know, the all the earthquakes, and very recently this 7.2 earthquake that left many people very impoverished, because although there were no damages as far as deaths or accidents, physical accidents of people, there are a lot of damaging of areas and streets and houses. And so people right now are suffering a lot, and they need a lot of support there. And so I guess also that the earthquake changes to the psyche of the communities there. And I wonder how would that be if I go again. I look forward to go again. If I ever got granted a permit to enter the States, I truly would love to go to the University of San Diego or somewhere else, and then go and visit my family as well. But thank you for the question. It's a nice question. It's very far from here, from Mexico City.
I am Carl Kreider. I wanted to ask, I really appreciate your comments on the sacrament of the Eucharist. I wanted you to comment further on extending the sacrament of marriage to same-sex couples.
Thank you so much. Well, my opinion and my view is very particular, and I realize that not many Christians and not many Catholics accept that, and I'm very respectful of all the sensitive. I'm very sensible to people not accepting gay marriages, and I understand their biblical and theological arguments. Nevertheless, for me, I guess the main argument has to do with love. I know it may sound cheesy, but it is true. I mean, it's about the gospel and Jesus Christ's incarnation, and the whole soteriology, the whole history of salvation has to do with love. If it doesn't have to do with love, then I don't know what it has to do about. But I think that's the main message. And if we root ourselves on God's love, then why we cannot accept people loving another person of their own sex? Why is that so? I know there are some biblical arguments, although as many biblical scholars now at this point of history have pointed out and have argued, those readings are just readings too, and we have to take it into context. There's a whole discussion on, for example, the invention of homosexuality, something invented in the 19th century. And so applying modern categories to biblical categories, I think that's also something that we have to look with more carefully. And so for me, yes, I am for gay marriages. I think that gay marriages can also be a face of a Trinitarian love, of a love within the Trinity, and they can be also testimonies, witnesses of God's love and fidelity. So that's my personal opinion. I don't know, maybe it's too far to talk about a sacrament of marriage for gay people. Maybe now for people to get too used to the idea of, and opening up to the idea and becoming more sensible to this idea of gay marriages, maybe we could implement in some communities gay unions and blessings to gay unions in your different communities, in your different parishes, wherever you are working in your pastoral fields. I encourage you to do so, to celebrate also with the community, so that they know that they are not rejected, but on the other hand, that they know that in the church, in the communities, they can also find themselves welcome and find themselves as brothers and sisters. So there's a lot to do.
Angel, I want to thank you for the wisdom of your presentation. And I'm not sure if you know this, but the previous presenter, Craig Wong, presented on ecclesiology. And I was wondering if there might be some connections in what you've said to some of the conversations we've had already today. And it seems like one of the ways that we might try to make some bridges is to think about how, in your own experience of life in the church, you've experienced some stigma within the church. And yet you talked about how hybridity and ambiguity and paradox is where God is found. And I wonder if you might take a little bit of time here to help make those connections for us, to both talk about the ecclesiological implications of the experience of stigma within the church, as well as this hopeful, more transformative understanding of the idea of ambiguity and paradox as the locus of where God is found, and whether you find that to be, you know, maybe a more hopeful view for the future, what kind of resources you find for having that hope within, you know, even a broken church community.
Thank you very much. I think, yes, great. You already answered the question very, very beautifully. So I don't know if I can add a little more. Trying to underline some points that you already made very, very rightly so. I think one first point, and the strongest, I guess, is this sense of becoming ecclesia, becoming a church. A church is not homogeneous. We are all different. And so when we are making church, when we are making ecclesial communities, we have to accept the plurality of the community. The community is not the same, and we are all different. And so I think one of the first challenge for the present and the future church is accepting the plurality in the church. In the case of Catholic Church, I think this is a very urgent challenge, because the Catholicity in itself means universality and locality at the same time. So it is plural already. It is already plurality. It's already celebrating difference. And so I think that one of the first things that we have to learn is to accept the plurality within the church. And the other one is related exactly to what you said about the stigma. I think that in the stigma we can find to the face of the crucified God, and try to move from crucifixion to resurrection. So it's something that we have to work on, that, how to heal the stigmas within the church. Who is the stigmatized in the church? We have to ask ourselves, in our communities, who are the ones who are left out? I remember when I was working with Latinos and Latinas in the United States and some parishes, there was this big, huge discussion with the pastor of the church, because he said, we have to let the Mexicans and the Latinos to come to the church and register here. But his attitude was, let them come here, let them register here, and then we're going to recognize them as members of the church. I think we have to do the other way around. And it's actually the most missionary and the most evangelical way, that for some reason the Catholic Church is losing that, because now they want the people to come to the church instead of we going to them where they are, there in the margins especially. And so I think that one thing that we have to learn is how to reach out, how to go outside the borders of our own communities where we feel secure, with people that are nice and we feel comfortable with. How to go beyond these borders and look for those who are outsiders, and how to learn how to include them in our own communities. I think that's a way to go, and there's still a very long way to continue walking, but I'm hopeful that we can start in our own communities. That's the way to go. Start from our own communities, and that's how we make church. That's how we make the true ecclesia.
Thank you. Well, on behalf